Welcome to Adoption Talk by Spence Chapin, the podcast where all the voices of the adoption constellation come together. Twice a month, this podcast brings you conversations with adoptees, birth parents, adoptive families, and adoption professionals as they share their experiences and discuss all things adoption. We're glad you've joined us. On today's episode, we discuss the important topic of ethics in international adoption with Spence Chapin Senior Director of International Adoption and Humanitarian Aid, Lauren Jang, and Senior Director of Legal and Compliance, Chelsea Guffey. Let's get started.
Everyone, and welcome to another episode of Adoption Talk by Spence Chapin. I'm Christine Pohl, Director of Development and Marketing at Spence, and today we will be discussing a very important topic, inter-country adoption and what steps are taken to ensure an ethical and permanent process for children and families. This is really important, especially for individuals and families who are considering international adoption as a way to grow their family, but also for adoption professionals and those in the adoption community to understand a bit more about what's involved in international adoption, how adoption agencies should be operating in order to ensure an ethical process that is in the best interest of each child. So I am really excited to be joined today by two colleagues, Spence Chapin, Senior Director of International Adoption Programs and Humanitarian Aid, Lauren Jang, who oversees all of our international adoption programs from the application stage to the post-adoption supervisions. And I'm also joined by our Senior Director of Legal and Compliance, Chelsea Guffey, who manages all of the adoption accreditations and licenses for Spence Chapin, in addition to so much more. But welcome to both of you, and thank you for being here.
Thanks so much, Christine. We're excited to have this conversation.
So to start the conversation off today, maybe Chelsea, you can just start at sort of the square one basic, why does inter-country adoption exist?
Of course, Christine. Yeah, I think any conversation about ethics, it's important to start big. And the critical question we have before us today, I think, is why does inter-country adoption exist at all? And to answer that question, I'm going to borrow a phrase that we often hear translated from our partners in Colombia, where they refer to the process of either reuniting a child in the child welfare system with their biological family or identifying an adoptive family for a child as a process called the restoration of the child's rights. And in this phrase, what this refers to of restoring a child's rights, it's making a reference to this global recognition that children have a right to a family. The Convention on the Rights of the Child is universally signed by every country in the world. It is ratified by almost every country in the world. And in that convention, there's some beautiful language that states that for the full and harmonious development of a child, that a child should grow up in a family environment, and that they need to be in an atmosphere of happiness, love, and understanding. And this is really the core of, you know, the conversation that we'll have today. Because this means that both there's a duty to protect the child's family unit and ensure that a child is never unnecessarily separated against his will from his or her family. But it also means that when separation does occur and it is necessitated, that there is an ethical obligation, a moral imperative, if you will, to ensure that this child's right to grow up in a family environment is protected. And so that's where we begin. That's why adoption exists. It's for those children who have a right to a family, and a family needs to be identified for them.
I love that, Chelsea. And I appreciate framing the conversation that way and starting off that way, because, you know, I think that there's a lot of times just, you know, inter-country adoption has existed for a really long time. You know, we might take it as for granted that it exists and it happens, but I think really looking at what that stems from and why that's in place really does guide this conversation. And when, in the cases when inter-country adoption does happen and a child does become eligible for inter-country adoption, how can an agency or a family be sure that it is an ethical process? What, you know, what are those measures that are in place that exist?
Yeah, of course. I'm happy to address that. I'm thinking that one big question still might be, you know, why is inter-country adoption the solution here for this mm-hmm. child? Why would a child tens of thousands of miles away that deserves to have this right restored? Why is a family in the U.S., you know, the right, the ethical option and solution for this child?
Right.
And I think that in order to understand that, it first might be helpful to lay out kind of some understanding about this principle called subsidiarity. And so subsidiarity is in some ways it's very complicated, very academic. There's different opinions about the interpretation, but essentially to boil it down and simplify it is the subsidiarity principle, which is a very important principle in the practice of inter-country adoption. It means that there needs to be a process before a child is identified as being eligible for inter-country adoption. Where that process starts is kind of where we started our conversation, you know, and that's, is this child being unnecessarily separated from the child's family of origin? So what are the factors that are leading to this child being unable to remain in that family of origin? Is this a situation of abuse and neglect where a child has been removed from their family of origin? Is this a situation of the child being orphaned by death of both parents? Is this a situation where biological parents are making a voluntary decision that they are either unwilling or unable to parent this child, and that they are, you know, requesting that this child be raised in another home? You know, is this an issue of abandonment where there is a responsibility to identify a child that's, you know, in care and whether or not any relatives exist for this child? So the first question is really, why is that child separated from their family of origin? And then is reunification with that family a possibility? So that's the first step in subsidiarity. Beyond that, then you broaden the circle a little bit, as if it's not the biological parents of this child, is there another relative that this child could be placed with so that the child still remains in their biological family context? If not that, is there someone from the community where this child resides, a person who could parent this child and provide that family setting for this child? And then essentially the idea of subsidiarity is you check all of these boxes and that circle keeps growing. And so what it means in the context of inter-country adoption is that all options for the child have been exhausted in the child's country of origin. And so this is inclusive of domestic adoptions in that country. And so Spenschapen, we work in Colombia, South Africa, and Bulgaria. All of the children that are being identified as children who are eligible to come to the United States for the purpose of adoption have no other options for adoption in the country where they were born and reside. And so what that means is that inter-country adoption is a last resort. And this last resort language we use a lot internally because, you know, when we take with us that charge of a moral imperative, it is, you know, I think it has two important elements behind it, the last resort. It's that first, all eligible options or all options for this child have been exhausted, which means that there has been a process to ensure that this child, you know, has the rights to a family in an orderly fashion that first looks at the child's original family. And then the other thing that is, I think, important about that last resort language means that, you know, we feel strongly that when a child has been identified for inter-country adoption, that the right family needs to be identified for that child so that that child can have a chance of growing up in a family environment. And so the subsidiarity principle, you know, that's a long explanation, but that kind of gives, I think, an overview of this idea that there's a process that gets to this, you know, in some ways, maybe very dramatic sounding solution for a child on the other side of the world, but really that there are so many steps that are happening before a child can be determined to be eligible for inter-country adoption.
Thank you so much, Chelsea. And you talked about, you know, that the principle is what guides the process, but the process that's in place, there are certain checks and balances that do exist, or certain ways in which Spence Chapin, for example, as an agency, can be sure that these processes, these steps are being taken, that families can be sure. So can you speak a little bit to what some of those are that do exist out there and how that works a little bit?
Of course. To answer this question, it's helpful to understand a little bit of the framework and the global framework that exists, because in 1993, there was an international treaty that was created to ensure ethical adoptions. And that was really the purpose of putting these processes down into writing. And so it's commonly referred to as the Hague Adoption Convention. And there are many nations that are a party to the Hague Adoption Convention. And essentially it lays out, you know, certain uniform expectations, checks and balances, and really provides a structure for what inter-country adoption should look like. Starting first with what the structure should be like in any nation that is a party to this treaty. So it starts with that kind of like, what's the national structure for any given country, any nation state? And what is at the core of that really is that there is a central authority. And so that all of these responsibilities in this treaty are centralized into one office, and that is responsible for, you know, enforcing this treaty mechanism. And there's also requirements that in order to ratify a treaty that you as a nation have restructured your laws and created laws that reflect all of the elements of the treaty. And so every nation that is a part of the Hague Treaty has done that. And then some of the other steps are, you know, essentially kind of following this guideline of subsidiarity. It's questions about eligibility of the child, you know, and determining that a child is eligible. It's also questions about who is going to adopt that child and the checks and balances that go into who's going to adopt that child. There's provisions about the immigration aspect, so the physical aspect of a child leaving one country and entering into another and ensuring that that process is smooth. So it's both functions as internal checks and balances and kind of this uniform best practice standard for each nation. And then it also goes into the cooperative aspect of inter-country adoptions, how countries should be, you know, with this recognition that we have the same processes, the same standards, that then we, you know, give deference and respect into that process and see each other as partner nations that are parties to this treaty. And so that's a lot of what governs, you know, kind of what are the eligibility factors in particularly a Hague country. And the United States, the way that we have interpreted that treaty is that we have uniform practices internally, and that our uniform practices really make sure that children that are immigrating from any country, whether they're a Hague country or non-Hague country, that we are going through basically a checklist that that treaty has been adhered to, and that this child is truly a child that is eligible for adoption, and particularly intercountry adoption.
And for a for an agency in the United States, like Spence Chapin, for example, who has international adoption programs, there is a pretty rigorous accreditation process for agencies like ours in order to be able to have our international adoption programs and to be able to follow through the process from the beginning to the end. And you mentioned that there are, so there's countries who are Hague countries and countries that are not Hague countries. Lauren, I was hoping that maybe you could speak a little bit to what some of the challenges that might exist in working with a non-Hague country. And then, you know, we can touch a little bit on what does this process look like for Hague countries? What does this look like on the ground?
Absolutely. And I think when it comes to what does the process look like in a non-Hague country, that word that Chelsea used moments ago about uniformity of practices as existing between and amongst Hague countries is operationalized differently in non-Hague countries. They are sovereign nations and have ability to develop their own processes, their own determinations of what makes a child in need of adoption, whether that's domestic or international. How is an adoptive family deemed eligible and suitable, whether that's a domestic family or an international family? And then how are we procedurally, as a non-Hague country, going to unite that child and that parent? And so there are differences between and amongst non-Hague countries in exactly what those ordering of processes look like, exactly who, what level of authority, whether it's at an NGO status, a local government, a national government, who is making those determinations of a child's eligibility, how is an adoption order granted? And I think what becomes particularly relevant to prospective American adoptive parents is twofold. You know, one, how am I going to satisfy those in-country requirements in the non-Hague country where I seek to adopt? And then importantly, how will I be united with my child in the U.S.? How will I immigrate my child back to the United States? And that's the importance of working with a U.S.-based adoption service provider that's Hague accredited before beginning any process in a non-Hague country, because you do ultimately need to be able to bring your child home and have them immigrate as your child and become a citizen of the U.S. And because that ordering happens differently in a child's process in a Hague country versus a non-Hague country, there can be scrutiny. There can be challenges on an individual child's case when it comes to immigrating that child to the U.S. from a non-Hague country, if an adoption service provider in the U.S. hasn't been guiding you through each step from the beginning. So in a Hague country, you know, again, Chelsea was speaking about ordering, sequencing, kind of a standardization of processes. And one element of that is that before a child is placed in the physical or legal custody of a U.S. parent adopter, that a pre-adjudication has been made, that USCIS, United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, has pre-adjudicated that that child is eligible for intercountry adoption, and that that match of that particular child with that particular family is suitable, and that the U.S. intends to allow that child to immigrate permanently to the U.S. as a Hague Convention adoptee, as a child who was adopted by an American citizen through the principles of the Hague.
And so, Lauren, not to interrupt, but so in that case, the parents or the prospective adopted parents are heading to the country to unite with their child with that assurance already in place in the case of a Hague, right?
Yes, absolutely. And when it comes to non-Hague processes, again, because there can be a difference of ordering or sequencing in which that country of birth will allow a process to unfold, we might see that a country has granted a U.S. adopter legal or physical or full parental rights to a child before that USCIS pre-adjudication has happened. And then it does become a process of really having to put forth an argument to USCIS with demonstrable evidence that this child has come into my physical care, my legal custody, or even my adoptive parenthood, not only through the standards of their birth country, again, we're speaking about non-Hague countries, but also that this child will meet USCIS definitions of who is eligible to immigrate permanently to the to the US on the basis of an adoption. So it is just, again, if you are thinking about adoption from a non-Hague country, the importance of beginning processes with a US-based Hague-accredited adoption service provider before beginning any process in that country of origin cannot be overstated.
Yeah. Yeah, because that, you know, that sounds like that can be a real nightmare, a real crisis, if you're not, you know, if you don't have the information beforehand and you're not working with someone who knows those processes in and out. And so in the case of a Hague country, then what does the process where, you know, so Chelsea spoke about, you have the central authority, you have, you know, a checklist of sorts of things that as a country you need to be doing in order to make sure that a child is eligible and that they'll meet all of the requirements. So what does that look like? I mean, what, you know, when you think about, as Chelsea said, you know, if the parents are unable, then you look a little bit broader, maybe to family members, but, you know, is it people going door to door? Is there, what kind of on the ground, what does it look like for countries?
Absolutely. So every country has the exact how-to checklist of steps delineated by the processes, the procedures that are possible within their country, but they are all going to, in Hague countries, kind of follow that principle of search within birth family, extended birth family, local domestic adopters, and then abroad. So I'll use South Africa as an example of how one country really procedurally carries out for each boy and girl the exact process to try to adhere to that orderance, mm-hmm. to try to first reunify with birth family. It is common in South Africa that we see children become entering into care and protection due to abandonment, which might be the starting point for their ultimate journey to either domestic or inter-country adoption. So in that instance, the very first step that happens are immediate efforts to try to find birth family. And that will look both like a social worker investigation as well as a police investigation. So using any piece of information that is known, now boots on the ground, for the term you used moments ago, are happening. So maybe that child was born at a hospital, in which case that biological mother must have given a name, an address, a phone number when she checked into the hospital. Social workers and police officers go to that address, call that phone number. We see instances where, you know, maybe that exact address doesn't exist, but there's a neighboring address, and then an interview happens with the person who's living at that neighboring address, and they say, you know, I haven't seen her in weeks or months, but last I heard she was heading to Durban, and now efforts go to try to find her in that location. So kind of following those leads. Of course, in the instance of abandonment, a child also, their immediate protection needs to be ensured. So a court inquiry will be opened so that a order can be rendered that says this child needs care and protection, and a child will enter into protective care, which in South Africa typically looks like an institution. But again, the moment that that child enters an institution is not the moment that it's deemed that that child is in need of adoption, because we need to continue to carry out those efforts with the birth family. So additional to those boots on the ground social worker and police searches, there's also a newspaper publication with any information known about the child's birth and circumstances, any information about the names or identities of birth mom and or birth dad or birth family members are published in the newspaper. With contact information of if you know anything about this child, if you are related to this child, if you are a neighbor or a kinship-like relation to this child, please call, please get in touch with us. So that notice is put out in a broad sense, really in a hopes that ideally, you know, maybe birth family will see it, or maybe a friend or relative of the birth family will see it and bring it to their attention so that that child can be, you know, looked at for reunification if that's suitable. If there is no response to that newspaper publication, and if the police investigation and if the social worker investigation are closed without finding, you know, a court can rule that this child is now in need of permanency through adoption. And the very first effort will be a domestic adoptive family for that child. So again, every country has slightly different procedures of how do we search for a domestic suitable adoptive family. But in South Africa, that process is something called RACAP, which is the Register of Adoptable Children and Adoptive Parents. And all adoptive parents on that register are domestic. They are South Africans. And they're nationwide. It is the whole country of registered adoptive applicants. And for a minimum of 60 days, that child needs to be on RACAP, so that every social services organization who has adoptive parents can look and see, are any of our parents approved for these characteristics? And then a match can be made domestically. And so it's only after that 60-day minimum period has lapsed and no domestic adopters are suitable for this child's particular constellation of needs, can a child be referred for intercountry adoption. And there, you know, intercountry adoption is looked at in the context of the child. You know, every child has different demographics, whether it's their age, whether it's the fact that they're a sibling group versus a single child, whether it's the types of special needs, emotional needs, behavioral needs that they have. Every child has unique characteristics that are going to require unique parenting. So when it comes to a match internationally, that fit, that suitability between what the parent is approved for and what the child presents with is the determining factor in which family will receive a referral.
Thank you so much, Lauren. And as you were talking, you know, you can't help but just think about this, you know, a child that has gone through this journey, all, you know, by the time they're eligible for intercountry adoption, you know, their need is so great for having that stability of a family. And you know, you mentioned the characteristics, and I love how, you know, you phrased the constellation of needs that a child might have. And you also, you know, the way that you pointed to going through this registry, like in the case of South Africa, and a child not being adopted by anyone that's interested in adoption in that country. So what kind of, you know, characteristics do children typically have that, you know, that we see, for example, with children in our South Africa adoption program?
Absolutely. Again, going back to that core, that intercountry adoption is a last resort when domestic options for permanency don't exist. We can imagine, we can understand why the children who ultimately become in need of intercountry adoption are children who have higher levels of need. That for whatever reason, whether there's you know, reasons within the culture of the birth country that adoptive families don't feel able, or whether there's resourcing in the adoptive birth in the birth country that domestic adoptive parents might not have access to the same resources that would enable them to parent children who have higher needs. Ultimately, what we see in intercountry adoption is that the boys and girls who need matched with families abroad are boys and girls with special characteristics. And what that looks like looks different in each particular country. You know, by and large, we are talking about placements of non-infants. As we just laid out many, many steps, each of those steps takes time. And so inter-country adoptions are not going to be of children in the first days, weeks, or months of life. So we're looking for families who are prepared to parent older children. That can range the gamut of age depending on the country. In South Africa, common characteristics that we see are prematurity, which can be ranging but can be significant. We see children born with low birth weight. We see children who have global developmental delays. So these are children who we know are going to need therapeutic services, whether that's OT, PT, speech therapy, all of the above. And we can't know exactly what that child's trajectory will be once they're in a loving environment, once they have those services. We see a range of medical diagnoses. Obviously, there are countless such diagnoses. And so what any particular child presents with is going to be unique to them. But common needs that we see in South Africa are HIV, or born to a biological parent with HIV, but didn't contract the diagnosis. We see children who have other managed communicable diseases. We see hepatitis B. We see history of syphilis that has been managed. We see physical differences. So whether it is a malformed organ or other, whether it's a malformed arm or underdeveloped limb, we do see that range of needs as well. In all of these cases, we're going to be preparing families for attachment and bonding to look different in the context of a child who's experienced loss, who's experienced grief, who's experienced institutionalization. In Colombia, the range of special needs looks a bit different. Colombia has very defined parameters of what that means based in who are the children who ultimately don't find permanency in Colombia. And they've defined several characteristics. Children over 10 years old would be considered, in the eyes of ICBF, Colombia's central authority, children with special characteristics. Sibling groups of three are, in the eyes of ICBF, Colombia's central authority, children with special characteristics. And then it's boys and girls who have disabilities, which they define as chronic, serious, permanent diseases or conditions that require support from the health system. And that, again, is a very broad category, but examples that have been given include cerebral palsy or hearing loss, epilepsy, cognitive deficits, behavioral disorders. So again, that's a very big range. But I think that it's really important as a family is exploring inter-country adoption and exploring what country, because again, every country has different standard characteristics, is to choose a program based in, am I eager and ready and prepared to parent a child with the types of characteristics commonly seen in this country. So as families are imagining going from this idea of I want to parent, I want to adopt, I want to give a family a home, now you have to narrow it. I want to give a child a home. Now you have to narrow in and choose your path. And there's going to be a kind of a determination of what path am I fit for. And that's based both in eligibility, but also in your readiness and your desire for what type of child do you envision parenting. So I always encourage families to first envision, what's my vision of my future son or daughter or children? How old are they? What are their needs and diagnoses? And that can help kind of narrow in on a pathway.
And thank you so much, Lauren. And one of the things that, you wove through what you were saying is in thinking about preparing families, right? And the preparation of families. And you also mentioned earlier, the importance of working with an agency that's Hague accredited, that's competent from the beginning, so that you do have, because I envision families, like, how do you know what characteristics you're open to in a child? How do you know what resources you need to look for in your community to be able to support a child? And I know that you are, and your team are prepare families from the very first step, from the application, and then all the way through, like after the child comes home, there's more preparation that is, you know, there's more training, there's more conversations, there's more assistance that's going on, support. And that training piece is critical. So, you know, in preparing families, it's guiding them, social workers guiding them and helping them make these decisions, but then also providing them with information and knowledge, because we're talking about children right now, but that child becomes a teenager and then becomes an adult. And adoption, as we say at Spenschapen, is a lifelong process, right? I mean, it's what is 5 years from now? What is 10 years from now? What is 40 years from now? And then also cultural elements of, you know, bringing a child from a different culture, from a different religion, maybe, or different upbringing to a completely new environment, a completely new country. And can you just speak a little bit to that? Because that, I think that piece is just so key in talking about ethics in adoption.
Absolutely. And I think that you encapsulated it perfectly, that training and preparation and, in a way, mutual assessment, right? You as the prospective family are continuing to assess whether this is the right path for you, while we as social workers and then later governmental authorities are assessing whether you're eligible and suitable as well. But that process of ongoing assessment and preparation and training begins at Spence from before you even officially join an adoptive program, and it lasts through a life course. So kind of in that pre-application phase, we take seriously the importance of making sure that a family moves forward in a country program with full understanding of who are the children and what are the processes. So we do require that families attend a country-specific webinar before applying. That's ensuring that we're giving you the information you need to know who are the kids, what are their needs, what are the timeframes, what are the processes, what are the eligibility standards, so that you're making an initial assessment of, I think I can parent a child with those needs. I think I can manage this process. Once a family is accepted into a program, preparation and training is woven throughout their home study, which is their approval processes. And you're going to receive training in a host of ways, some through online learnings, some through book reports and readings and written exercises. But the part that I get most excited about is a training series that Spence delivers live to our families. We have families nationwide, so we're delivering this through Zoom so that it's accessible to everybody. But it is an opportunity to really share information and then dialogue with families about the needs and characteristics of children. So we will start with attachment. What is attachment? How does it get disrupted? Why does it get disrupted in children who've been separated from birth family, in children who've been institutionalized or in foster care? What is your own attachment profile, and how will that influence the way that you're kind of programmed to respond to your child, and how might you need to respond differently or modify your approach based on your child's trauma history? The training will talk a lot about behavioral manifestations of trauma. You know, in children who've been adopted, we do see both externalizing and internalizing behaviors. So a child who might, you know, have difficulties with behavioral regulation, or who might struggle with some deeply felt feelings of grief, loss, and what are the parental interventions to support a child with those histories, kind of those traditional parenting styles that have maybe worked for you if you've parented a child born to you, or who've worked for friends or family who've parented children who don't have trauma histories. We might need a different approach for a child who has a trauma history. So how do we equip you for those types of approaches? We spend a lot of time talking about race and transracial parenting and helping your child develop a strong sense of ethnic and racial identity. And also some really honest and direct conversations that racism persists in this world. Bias and discrimination persist in this country. And how are you going to talk with your child about that reality? How are you going to prepare your child as a, you know, 6-year-old exploring race versus a 12-year-old, 15, and then, as you said, as an adult and beyond? how do you as a parent address and matters of discrimination and racism in our society? How do you take that upon yourself? One of our trainings is led by a staff member here at Spence who herself was transracially, transculturally, transnationally adopted. And she provides a lot of information about identity development. We also bring in a pediatrician who specializes in intercountry adoption medicine to talk about what are the common diagnoses that are seen in these different countries, and then what are the care needs so that you can assess, you know, can I realistically accommodate those care needs? Some care needs are going to have weekly or daily medical or therapeutic interventions. Some might have more spread out therapeutic or medical interventions, but maybe more intense, like a surgery. How can your life accommodate those differences? Because that's an important part of deciding your final approval characteristics. So you and your social worker together will define not just are you approved to adopt, but what characteristics of child are you ready and prepared for? So your home study will ultimately conclude with what age of child and what range of special needs are you approved for, so that that referral that comes to your family is hopefully one that really is a child who you can parent. But that training is ongoing. So once you do receive a referral, you know, now we have real information about a real boy or girl or siblings. And so now we need to dive in and really prepare as much as possible for the anticipated needs of this child. We call it child-specific training. So we will develop a plan with you to meet again with a pediatrician and talk about this particular child's diagnoses and care needs. We will, you know, provide readings and online courses and in-person sessions with you about any known need that this child has. And one of the elements that we weave into every family's process at the time of child-specific training is a session, at least one session with one of our post-adoption clinical social workers to talk about the anticipated impact of this child's history, their emotional behavioral profile, their special needs profile on you and your family life. You know, I think it's important that we take that opportunity to give voice to what your experience could be in parenting this child. How might you be triggered in light of this particular child's experiences and needs? So for example, if a referral made to a family includes a known history of sexual abuse, and you as an adoptive parent have that in your history of childhood, you know, we're really going to sit and we're really going to talk with you about how do you manage your own triggers in light of what this child's needs may be. So it is this holistic approach of preparing for the child, but also preparing you and the management of your own needs through this. And then you'll travel to the country and, you know, we'll be having Zoom or video sessions together to really explore what's going on. How are you adjusting? How is the child adjusting? What supports do you need? And then you'll come home with your child and the lifelong of post-adoption services begins. So there's going to be some required home visits at certain intervals. Every country does set standards of how often a social worker needs to visit you post-adoption and report on your family's adjustment, which is also an important opportunity for you to have the undivided attention of a social worker to support you or your child in what you're managing. And then there's, you know, lifelong trainings, workshops, social events that we always encourage families to stay a part of.
Thank you so much, Lauren. And, you know, I think that this really brings this whole conversation back a little bit to, you know, what we sort of started with, which is that each child, every child, it's our, at Spence Chapin, it's our mission, but every child deserves a family and every child deserves love. And all of these processes are in place in order to provide that, in order to ensure that that's done right, that that's done ethically, that that's done in a way that is in the best interest of each child. And whether it's, you know, the central authorities that are in the country with their checklists, whether it's, you know, the auditing that Spence Chapin goes through in order to keep, you know, maintain our accreditation and have someone overlooking and making sure that everything is in place. Or it's the trainings that we're doing for families so that they can do that introspection and do that real work that they need to do before they're bringing a child home. That's the big picture. Those are the little pieces. And I know that we could go on forever talking about the details and the nuances of those pieces, but I think that this conversation maybe scratched the surface, but does paint a picture of everything that goes into ensuring that inter-country adoption is done ethically and in the best interest of each child.
Absolutely, Christine. And just to add very briefly to that, because I think that was a perfect summary, and it speaks directly to the two primary principles, ethical principles that are laid out in the Hague Adoption Convention. And one pillar is about prevention of exploitation, sale, trafficking of children. And so those prevention methods, those protective methods are about ensuring that when a child is separated from their biological family, that there is reasons for that, and that there's legal processes to determine whether that child should be reunited or whether that child should be placed in another family setting. And so that's the checks and balances that we started talking about. And then everything that Lauren laid out with our processes at Spinch Chapin and the collaborative work that we do with our foreign countries and with our foreign partners in the countries that we work really gives, I think, a lot of life to the other principle, which is that every inter-country adoption should be happening in the best interest of that particular child. And so that's everything that Lauren talked about, of the work that goes into ensuring that this adoption is in this particular child's best interest, means that we're looking at all of those factors. We're looking at not only in that all of the checks and balances happened from the legal process that brought this child to the point of eligibility, but we're looking at this child as a human, as a person, as what their needs are, what their characteristics are, what they desire. And so it's a preservation of all of those rights of the child when we use the phrase best interest. So that's preservation of their right to family. It's a preservation of their right to have a voice. If they are a certain age, that they are participating in their adoption plan and what they want in the characteristics of an adoptive family. It's their right and preservation to their culture, to their language of origin, that these things are things that we are educating our adoptive families on so that that can be preserved for this child. And so this best interest of the children is really driven by this full spectrum of a child's rights as a person and which family is going to ensure the protection of those rights through the rest of this person's life. And so, you know, I think that Lauren laid out beautifully the ways that we show due diligence and commitment to that goal of best interest for each child that we're placing for adoption at Spence Chapin.
Thank you so much, Chelsea. And thank you, Lauren, for providing us with all of this information today. Like I said earlier, you know, this was an incredible conversation, but there is so much more to know and to learn about inter-country adoption. And so I, you know, just want to encourage listeners, if you do want to learn more about international adoption at Spence or in general, our Lauren and her team are always available to be able to answer any questions you may have. We can be contacted at our website. There's contact forms there. There's our phone number. We're always a phone call away. Are there any other resources, Lauren and Chelsea, that you feel might be helpful for folks who are either starting this process of thinking about international adoption for themselves, for their families, or those who are just interested in learning more about this topic?
There is a world of resources, but if I could narrow it down to just a few, I would encourage everyone to visit adoption.state.gov. The State Department is the central authority of adoptions in the United States, with oversight of adoptions into and out of the United States. Their website has incredible information about the Hague Convention, the processes. You can click through country information to learn about any country around the world and their practices, their structures, their eligibility standards, how many adoptions have happened from that country. You can spend days and days on that website. But then to think separately about resources for preparation, resources for understanding the attachment needs, the behavioral needs, the medical needs of adopted children. Any reading or work by Karen Purvis is great, particularly her book, The Connected Child, that really helps families understand attachment and attachment-focused parenting interventions. And there's also a resource, Creating a Family, I believe it's .org. They have many articles, blog posts, but what I love the most is their radio show, their podcast, which at this point must have hundreds of episodes, all on topics about needs of children, pathways to family formation. In their name, Creating a Family, you can see that they explore all avenues of creating a family. So there's information on there as well if you're exploring ART or other family formation. But about half of their content is great on adoption, adoptive parenting needs, the needs of adopted children.
Lauren, I would also maybe just add to that list the National Council for Adoption. They have a lot of really helpful articles to for families, and they're a great resource. And then also the accrediting entity in the United States is referred to as IAMI, the Intercountry Accreditation and Maintenance Entity. And they have resources on all of the accredited agencies in the United States, and particularly what countries they work in. So that's also helpful information for anyone that is particularly looking at an agency in their geographic location, but you don't have to work with an agency within your geographic location for intercountry adoptions. So it also gives information on particularly what country each agency works in. So that's helpful too.
Thank you both. Those are incredible. And we'll make sure to have those up somewhere for listeners to have access to more directly. And the only other thing I would just want to add, that in addition to contacting Lauren and her team and, you know, going to the Spence Chapin website, we do also offer 101 webinars frequently that give a really great overview of our international adoption programs. And while Spence Chapin facilitates adoptions through Hague countries only, we are able to provide assistance to families that are in the area who want to do a home study. And, you know, as Lauren mentioned, that a home study, you know, is not only making sure that the family has everything in place to begin the process, but it's also a really great opportunity to connect with a Spence Chapin social worker and have that guidance that Lauren was referring to early on in, you know, starting those first steps in your adoption journey. So so that's also something that is a resource that's available, and there's information on our website about that. But thank you so much, Chelsea and Lauren. This was wonderful. And I hope that we can continue the conversation at some point about this or any of the other number of topics that that you both are so knowledgeable in. So thank you for sharing this time with us.
Thank you so much, Christine. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Adoption Talk. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to subscribe and leave us a rating wherever you get your podcasts. You can also head to spence-chapin.org/adoptiontalk to leave feedback, suggest episode topics, and sign up for updates on the latest episodes. See you next time.